Ever since the first atomic bomb used in anger was exploded over Hiroshima in August 1945, the public has been aware of the direct effects of the detonation of a nuclear weapon. These words begin just one of researcher ecologist Anne Ehrlich's many writings on the subject of nuclear winter, a chilling term itself, and the environmental effects of the arms race. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Welcome, please, Anne Ehrlich. On this edition, what the arms race has done to the planet and the atmosphere and how we might respond to it. Welcome, Anne. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good. Nuclear winter perhaps is not as looming a problem as it was before the two largest nations relaxed their tensions somewhat, but I want to spend at least some minutes at the early part of our hour taking a look at it. The World Health Organization, some decade ago or so, said that it felt 750 million to a billion people might be killed close to outright in a major nuclear conflagration, after which a nuclear winter would form. Is that kind of a, in 1994, is that kind of a major nuclear war something that you fear?
Well, obviously I don't fear it to the same degree that we would have 10 years ago, or even 5 or 6 years ago. The Cold War is over. It's been declared over, even officially, and the Russians are no longer the threat to us that they might have been 10 years ago, if only because their society is in somewhat disarray and because they have stepped back somewhat, and so have we, mm-hmm. from the sort of hair-trigger preparedness that we had
and
those years.
No other nation of anywhere near the size is anywhere near as dangerous.
That's right. No other arsenal is anywhere near the threat to us that theirs was.
If you look at the future and nuclear war in the same breath, do you see it happening on a smaller scale?
It's entirely possible. That's why nonproliferation is now the biggest concern that we have with regard to nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about that.
Okay. The question is other powers gaining control of the atom, and the military atom, if you like. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why we're so concerned today about North Korea, which is behaving in such a recalcitrant way. It appears that it is making atomic weapons secretly, although not so secretly, because there's enough evidence around to convince us that, in fact, they have gotten quite close to making nuclear weapons. And this is a very serious concern for the whole world community.
Is a nation like North Korea... Does a nation like North Korea seem more dangerous because it's out of the fold of the community of nations? Is that where the danger comes in, that it may not respect the sanctity of other nations?
Yeah, it's pretty much of an outsider in the community of nations. It is very isolated and somewhat paranoid in its reactions to behavior of its neighboring countries, including South Korea.
Mm-hmm. Other nations strike you in the same way as North Korea does?
There are a few others that are as isolated or perhaps not as communal, but most of them don't have nuclear weapons or the likelihood of getting them.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few other nations that have nuclear weapons, although they are not what we call declared nuclear powers.
Meaning
that they have... They have never admitted openly that they possess them. Pakistan is one that is on the verge of having a nuclear weapon. Israel has them but has never publicly acknowledged the fact, although I guess they have tacitly by now.
Mm-hmm.
And South Africa at one time. But it never formally announced that it had it, denied it, in fact, even though there was evidence that they had exploded at least one. And then at the end, I believe it was de Klerk, announced that, in fact, they did have a nuclear capability. I'm not sure exactly what capability, whether they actually had bombs or were just in a position to produce one within a few weeks. But in any case, they were dismantling that whole apparatus. Mm-hmm. And they did announce that a few years ago.
This is Ann Ehrlich. She has, since the 1950s, been doing work on issues related to population and issues related to the environment. We're talking today about nuclear winter and the effects of the arms race. On a numeric, or however you want to look at it, scale, then we are much safer than we were, and only in terms of kind of the particular insanity of the moment might mm-hmm. the world be in danger?
Yes, I would say the finger has been removed from the red button. Mm-hmm. A good many of the weapons that were the likeliest to launch a war have been removed from the areas where they could do so, particularly in Eastern Europe and Central Europe. The so-called theater weapons, the smaller scale ones, have all been taken away from there on both sides.
As a global watcher, do you take this to be wisdom or luck?
Well, I think there's probably an element of luck, but I think there's a fair amount of wisdom been involved, too. A lot of decisions have been the right decisions, I'm happy to say, in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And a good decision on one side often leads to a good decision on the other side, which is a very heartening thing to see.
Because you spent so much time looking at what a nuclear winter might be, can we take a few minutes to look at that now?
Sure.
The phrase nuclear winter all by itself is chilling.
I think it did have some propaganda effect, and it was extremely valuable. It's interesting that the Soviet government paid more attention to it than our government did. Our government for a while was even denying that such a thing could possibly, you know, happen. And the Russians took it very seriously from the beginning.
In what way? How did they talk about it or think about it that we didn't?
Well, Russian scientists built models, climate models, to try to confirm the results, and they did. They came up with slightly different results, but they had different models, too, generally not as sophisticated as some of the ones that were worked on this side, but quite adequate to confirm the results, which they did, and there began to be exchanges between us. Soviet scientists came over here and talked to our scientists and spent time in the laboratories of the scientists who were doing some of the modeling work, and so they were very active in it, even in the very first conference, which was used to announce the scientific results of the nuclear winter findings in 1983. There were several Soviet scientists, including the vice president of the Soviet Academy of Scientists, who was a close advisor to Gorbachev when Gorbachev came to power a few years later. So right at the highest level, and Soviet scientists were very much more closely involved with the government than our scientists are or have been.
What did the modeling show, if you can strike an image in the mind of a listener for nuclear winter? What does that mean to you?
Well, it showed that the result of hundreds or even thousands of detonations, such as you would have in a full-scale nuclear war, would produce enormous amounts of very thick black smoke and clouds of debris, depending on where they were exploded, high in the atmosphere or on the ground. and this would be lofted far into the atmosphere, some of it into the stratosphere, where the air movement is much less, when they would stay there for many weeks, perhaps months, blocking out sunlight from the surface.
Which means both heat and light.
Exactly. And therefore, temperatures would drop very sharply and remain low. The earliest models were relatively simple, and they suggested that there was a continuous cloud with no variation in it, you know, spreading across the whole northern temperate zone, which is where most human beings live, I might add. Mm-hmm. And certainly all of the people in the developed countries live. So this covering of cloud would block out the sun for several weeks and drop temperatures to very low levels, well below zero. And the first results, as I said, suggested this was a uniform effect. In fact, it wasn't. As later models showed, it would be much more spotty and patchy, and the smoke would drift in large clouds across the areas. Every time a thick patch came, of course, the temperature would plummet. When a thick patch passed, they would warm up again.
Yeah.
And consequently, in very unpredictable ways, the temperature would be fluctuating between normal or a little less than normal to very low. In many ways, this is even worse for biota than the uniform low temperatures.
Because we can adjust to the one, but we have to keep adjusting
to
the other?
And plant life in particular, which is the most critical part. That's what our food base is. Plants can adjust to very low temperatures and survive them. As we know, going through a winter, it's obvious that they can. But they can only do it once. Or maybe twice. Occasionally, you get a false winter. You know, during autumn, you get a very cold snap, and then it'll warm up again. And then it'll get cold again and stay cold. And a plant can adjust to maybe one of those changes, but it can't do it more than once or twice because it just uses up its energy reserves to keep adjusting. So it would kill a lot of plants that normally might survive even a very long cold winter in the temperate zone. And, of course, in the tropics, plants have no resistance at all to low temperatures and lack of sunlight.
And for other life on the ground, what's your picture? What's the image that comes to mind on the ground during the first weeks or months of nuclear winter?
Well, first of all, there would be enormous physical devastation, and this we have always known. And enormous numbers of people who were anywhere near the center of detonation for each weapon would be killed just by the blast effects, and secondarily by high levels of radioactivity. The radioactivity also would persist afterwards for many weeks in some places. There would be hot spots and areas that were relatively free of radioactivity, depending in part on the winds at the time and all sorts of other factors. And unfortunately, radioactivity is undetectable unless you happen to carry Geiger counters around with you all the time. So people would have no idea whether it was safe to go somewhere or not.
We're walking through it and
breathing. Yeah, they could just walk through
it
trying to find food and get themselves a very high dose of radioactivity without knowing it. Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether everybody knows what happens to the body if it walks through a high density area of radioactivity. What would happen to your body if you did that?
You would receive a dose of radioactivity.
But, I mean, what does that do to the insides?
Well, it does a number of things, and a lot depends on the size of the dose. Mm-hmm. A very high dose will kill you within a few hours. A lower dose might kill you anywhere from one day to 6 weeks. Remember the survivors of Chernobyl. Some of them lasted for several weeks, but then they died. Even if you survive, you're likely to have had a very severe damage to your immune system, among other things. So you become very susceptible to diseases and to other problems. So even with recovery, you could have a long recovery period because of the immune depression and also because of generalized damage to various organs. And I'm trying to remember all this.
Right.
It's been a while since I thought about it. And like taking radiation therapy, you might lose some of your hair. Mm-hmm. And you certainly might induce a cancer later on or mutations in your gonads, which would result in defective children.
Understanding that we were at war with Japan and that the war with the on both sides of the water with the Nazis and with Japan had felt interminable.
Mm-hmm.
Are those two reasons enough not to be internationally horrified by what happened at Hiroshima? All the things that you're describing that happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki did not stay with us as things that could happen to us.
Well, I think they stayed with the generation that was old enough to understand it at the time. I'm not sure how much younger people have been told in the way of the details of it.
But we were comfortable as a nation, comfortable enough with this notion to engage in an arms race beginning in the 40s and 50s.
That's right. And we've found out since that the government did a lot of things to try to minimize to the public how dangerous nuclear weapons were. For example, they rather deliberately fuzzed the difference between an atom bomb and a hydrogen bomb. Most young people don't know the difference. And a hydrogen bomb is many times more powerful than a simple atom bomb of the type that was exploded at Hiroshima.
So the government's presentation was that this is just another bomb.
Just another,
that we're making.
Just another bomb. Yeah. Of course, most of the modern ones are hydrogen bombs.
Mm-hmm. We're talking today with Ann Ehrlich. She and Paul Ehrlich have been partners in marriage and partners in research since the 50s. They have been working. They have concentrated some part of their studies with the issue of population control. Paul's first book was The Population Bomb. He and Anne have written together many books since then. The most recent on that subject is The Population Explosion. Anne Ehrlich has... Hold on a second here. A book most recently on the subject of the arms race and its environmental effects, co-edited by Ann Ehrlich, is called Hidden Dangers. Came out in 1990 from the Sierra Club. Ann Ehrlich is with us today as a guest of the Institute of Arctic Biology. She, with Paul Ehrlich, has been participating in the Irving Scholander Memorial Lecture visit, in this May of 1994. Her subject, her specialty on this visit to Conversations, is the environmental effects of the arms race. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Did the government fuzz, as you say it, in the interest of priorities, national security, it felt that the arms race was the higher need?
Mm-hmm. I presume so. That was because the defense against the evil communist empire was paramount in importance and didn't want people overly scared, but they certainly wanted them to support their arms program.
This is an issue in a democracy. What remains hidden for in the interest of a priority, and what the people have a right to know. As a researcher who's gone deeply into this subject, is it acceptable for a government to do that from your perspective, or does the public always have to know what the government is doing?
Well, I think the public that knows the most about what the government is doing is the best off. I think that intelligent oversight is absolutely essential, and it's very clear from the record of how they ran the arms program that, in fact, citizen oversight was badly needed and certainly lacking. The whole enterprise was conducted under a shroud of secrecy.
Introduce us to that enterprise. This is munitions creation under the Department of Energy.
Right. The nuclear weapons were all manufactured under the Department of Energy. It used to be the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission. And both the weapons program and civilian nuclear power plants were under the same operation for a long time. And then during the 1970s, they were separated. And both were still in the Department of Energy, were eventually reconsolidated in the Department of Energy, but in totally separate parts of it. But the defense side stayed under a shroud of secrecy. And whereas the civilian program was subjected to a good deal of citizen scrutiny, and I think it benefited a great deal from that.
Mm-hmm. The defense projects were across the nation, it seems.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. It's an enormous enterprise. If it were a separate private enterprise, it would be in the top 20 of the Fortune 500. It's a huge thing. It was 17 facilities in 12 states scattered all over the lower 48. And subjected to no real oversight from any independent agency at all.
You, in I think an introduction to Hidden Dangers, you charged that the deficit that we have today is at the door of Jimmy Carter for accelerating the arms race as he did, and then President Reagan for keeping that going in a major way. Both sides.
President Reagan upped the ante considerably, in fact, over what Carter did. Carter did a little bit of an increase in the program, and then Reagan increased it even more. And it's very interesting that the deficit that mushroomed during the 1980s was just about equal to the amount of money that we put into the arms program, or into the defense program, the whole defense program. Now, you have to remember that the weapons making part of it was really only a small fraction. But it was definitely increased. The output was increased during that time.
I'm not sure. I wanted to ask you something about the deficit, but I'm not quite sure what that was. Maybe it was just striking to me when I read
it. Yeah, that the defense budget increases just about equal the size of the deficit by the end of the 1980s. Mm-hmm. If we stayed on the old defense budget trajectory, the deficit would not be nearly as big.
When you say that there was not sufficient oversight, how large a statement is that? Were there small errors made, large errors?
Oh, huge errors, huge, huge travesties of justice. Remember, very recently we found out about all the radiation experiments that were done on people without their consent or without proper consent and without proper safeguards. That was part of that same program.
How remarkable do you think it is that the Clinton administration has revealed that?
Extremely remarkable. Actually, it was Secretary O'Leary who insisted that it be done. And it's absolutely to her credit that she did it. And moreover, promised that there would be some kind of recompense to the victims, many of whom have tried to get recompense but were never recognized as being real victims. Mm-hmm. For years, they've tried to get something from the federal government with no success. Those who knew that they were victims. Now, there were others who, with the release of these documents, found out that they were victims for the first time. Mm-hmm. But that's only a small part of the story, believe it or not.
Let's take another small part of the story. This is another anecdotal remark that I read in one of the chapters of Hidden Dangers, that at, let me see what the name of the, that at the Oak Ridge munitions plant in Tennessee in 1944, it was discovered that they were going to have some waste that they didn't know what to do with at that point. And the director of the plant called for a garbage can with a lid on it to have red lettering placed across the side and then have it taken out to the burn yard so that it would be separate from the other waste. This I found remarkable when I was reading it.
Yeah.
But if this is the most ludicrous way to deal with waste from a munitions factory, fill us in on some of the other ways.
I hate to say it, but that was somewhat typical of the way things were treated in those days, back in the 40s. In those days, we were really pretty naive about the dangers of radioactivity. We knew a lot, but we didn't know what we know today. And the people who handled it were comparatively careless and cavalier in their handling of it. The thing that is so shocking about the DOE facilities is that this attitude of the 1940s persisted into the 1980s.
Why?
Well, in part because they were still behind that secrecy shroud. Everything was classified. Nobody knew what was happening. And people who lived near a facility were aware that some things were wrong and things had happened. But they didn't have any solid information. And they couldn't get any solid information. And they didn't have any idea that this was happening in 16 other installations around the country. Every single one of them has, for example, wastes that have gotten into groundwater in the area and in many cases have polluted wells. Wells in Cincinnati had to be closed, for example, because of contamination in the water table from a plant that was only 60 miles away from them.
Can you take a plant like the one, say, close to Cincinnati and describe what's happening again or what was happening?
Well, they've now all been closed down, of course, and now what DOE is facing is a mammoth cleanup that dwarfs the rest of the cleanups that we have to do under Superfund, for example. In fact, several thousand Superfund sites are located on military installations and on the DOE facilities. in the case of the larger facilities like Hanford and Savannah River, the individual sites run into the hundreds. So it's almost unimaginably vast. And the character of the waste is different from civilian waste in that a lot of it is highly radioactive as well as extremely corrosive or toxic. And it's all mixed together. And often they don't even know exactly what's in the mix because the records weren't kept. Or if they were kept, they were lost from back in the 1940s and 50s. Record keeping in those days was somewhat casual, to say the least. And so it's not even known exactly what's in some of those tanks. Some of them might be explosive. The Soviets actually had a disastrous explosion with a similar set of mixed wastes in their analogous compound and had to evacuate a whole area as a result of it. This is back in the 50s when their explosion occurred. But the tanks at Hanford Reservation in Washington State have a very similar problem potential.
Can you take that plant, that disposal site, or another one with which you're familiar, and show us how those wastes are stored or disposed of and what's happening as a consequence of their storage or disposal?
Well, at Hanford, they've been stored in something like 170 different enormous tanks that are sunk into the ground, but they are not. They're single shell. And they've been leaking since the 1940s, many of them.
So the what's in there is a corrosive quality that has, has leaked
through
the metal.
Very corrosive material.
Okay.
The corrosive acids that are used to separate plutonium from uranium in the process of making it. And a lot of plutonium is mixed into it. So this miserable mess has been leaking out of the tanks into the soil.
And once it gets into the soil, then?
Then it keeps on leaking and eventually can reach the groundwater. And some contaminants have actually reached and leaked into the Columbia River. The compound is about 100 miles upstream from Portland, Oregon. And they've found evidence of radioactivity in the Columbia River all the way down to the mouth and affecting some of the fisheries in the river. So that's just one example. And the volume of waste is almost unimaginable, but quite apart from the fact that it's so nasty, they literally don't yet know how they're going to deal with it. The technology hasn't been invented, and they also have to try to figure out exactly what's in each tank. Mm-hmm. Among other things, over the years, they used to pour materials back and forth between the tanks.
Why?
Mixing them even further? I'm not sure. I really don't know. They must have had a reason, but I don't know what it was. Perhaps to dilute the radioactivity or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they did that. Some of the lower-level wastes, they just dumped in unlined pits, or just poured it into the soil into the 1980s in some places. They were still just rototilling wastes into the soil. Completely irresponsible.
Do you suppose the hope was that it would just
fade
away? Oh,
yeah, the philosophy was dilution is the solution.
Seriously? Pollution.
Yeah, seriously. And in other cases, they totally underestimated how rapidly these things move underground. It was estimated at Savannah River in South Carolina that material poured into the soil wouldn't reach the water table for a million years. And then they were very surprised when it got there 20 years later.
We're talking with Ann Ehrlich. She is a senior researcher at Stanford, a senior research associate in the Department of Biological Sciences, and has been such since 1975. She began working at Stanford in 1959 when she and her husband, Paul Ehrlich, moved to Palo Alto. They've been there ever since. Ann Ehrlich with us today on Conversations. Can we look at direct and indirect effects of this kind of leaching? When you say the people of Cincinnati were for a certain amount of time, 2 years, I think, drinking water out of their wells that had been contaminated by the plant
Probably
disposal
for a while,
nearby.
Yeah. They had to close all the wells in that area. anyway, find an alternative water source for those people.
What happened? Or what might have happened? Is there any way to know yet?
Well, presumably higher cancer rates among the people, among other things, birth defects ultimately, various problems. And they have found those. They have been rumored around many of the facilities for years, but no very good responsible tests of public health have been made, or for that matter, studies of the health of the workers in the plants until very recently. Now they're beginning to do it, and they're finding out some interesting things, but it's too early to say exactly what happened.
Because there's just not enough study yet.
Well, and it's also you're tracking people over almost 50-year period in some cases. Hanford was opened during World War II. And some of the worst things that happened occurred in the 40s and 50s. And many of the people, of course, have moved away. And a lot of the workers have died in the meantime. Or they moved away, too. And they're very hard to track them down, find out what happened to them. So it'll take a long time to do a responsible epidemiological study of the workers, particularly from the earlier years when things were the worst, although they didn't improve very much.
Is such a study happening, or have
yes.
such
oh,
studies
yes.
been
Oh,
begun?
Yes, there are. There are studies going on at several of the locations, and there have some that have been done also. But earlier, when there was one fairly responsible study attempted at Hanford, and the guy was being honest in his work, and they didn't like his results, so they fired him and suppressed the study.
You're very pessimistic about all this, aren't you?
Oh, no. I think things have changed enormously in the last 5 years. It's just amazing. The problem is that we are now left with this incredible legacy of this mess that we have to clean up, and American taxpayers are going to have to pay the bill. It's going to cost them at least as much to clean it up as it cost to make the weapons in the first place. And we have to worry about the weapons themselves. This is an additional problem that we're now facing. We're already dismantling them. We have dismantled, in fact, several thousand weapons already. But this just means taking them apart and recycling the pieces of the delivery system, the missile, for example. But we still have the plutonium pits. And what are we going to do with those?
Pit means?
Pit is the... It's a term that they use for the plutonium ball that's at the center. We're not allowed to know what shape it really has, but the thing that's at the center of the warhead and is the most important part of the explosive component. And there's also a large amount of highly enriched uranium in it, too.
And one assumes there are thousands, tens of thousands?
Oh, yeah, tens of thousands, yes, yes. We had somewhere between 20 and 30,000 weapons in our arsenal, and the Soviets had as many or more. We don't know exactly how many.
For people who don't understand what can or cannot be done with plutonium or uranium in pit form, what's...
Well, you can store it. Oh. That's about it. But plutonium is going to be a very serious disposal problem that we face in the future, because... Well, theoretically, it might someday be used in breeder reactors as a fuel source. It's not likely to. And in the meantime, it poses an enormous danger because it is something that someone could steal and turn into bombs. It's the proliferation issue.
So security is the greatest hazard.
Yes.
Here.
So
not leaking,
whatever we do decide to do with plutonium, and we have to come to look at it as a liability, not as an asset, as the nuclear industry is prone to do. Think of it as an asset. It's not. It's a liability. It's a danger to the whole world. So we have to think of a way to dispose of it that will, first of all, minimize the dangers to the people who have to handle it. It's radioactive stuff, after all. And also that will keep it away from the public for thousands of years. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. That means it has to be kept away from biological systems for 500,000 years. And one time the AEC guaranteed to do that, and the AEC, I think, was abolished 5 years later. So.
As long as the grass shall grow.
That's right.
This is Ann Ehrlich with us on Conversations. Tell me about the cleanup when you talk about this muck that you describe. We can't mop it up. We can't wash it out, right? How is something like this cleaned? What does cleaning mean when you're talking about?
Well, I assume what it would mean in this case would be dealing with the waste in some way, segregating it from the public. It's highly radioactive. It's very dangerous, highly corrosive and everything else. Miserable stuff to deal with in any way. One possibility is to glassify it, turn it into solid bricks that can then be buried deep in the earth somewhere. And this is probably what will ultimately happen to it. And one possibility for disposing of the plutonium, and in fact perhaps the most promising one, is to mix it in with those mixed wastes. Because extracting the plutonium from that, from someone who wanted to get it and make bombs, would be extremely difficult technically.
When you turn waste into glass bricks, separating that from the plutonium pit topic for a minute, what's the process for doing that? And I gather then that its presence in the ground, because it doesn't leach anywhere, is not a danger.
It's
relatively
solid.
Inert when it's.
It's quite inert, yes, and will remain so for a long time. At least that is the hope. Now, developing a glassification process for something that includes the corrosive acids may be difficult. They may have to separate the acids somehow before they can do it. I don't know. I think they're still working on that one.
And why bury it once it's glassified?
Because it's very radioactive, and you don't want it around people.
So it's not it really inert.
It is a contaminating substance.
It's still contaminating.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, the radioactivity will still be there. So it should be stored somewhere where it's not posing a danger to human beings or to other living things. Mm-hmm. And where people in the future, assuming that something exists in the way of a civilization which might have no memory, is unlikely to stumble across it. Could interpret any warning signs we might erect.
This sounds like a fairly simple process. Is it a simple process?
Not at all. No, it's very technical, and I don't know the technical details.
Okay. But it's a big, complicated step.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. Tell me about the psychological effects of this kind of contamination, whether we're looking at Hanford or at the plant outside of Cincinnati or
hundreds of miles
away from any of them. What's your sense of the impact on this nation of the arms race and the contamination that has accompanied it?
Well, by and large, the public is still unaware of the size of the problem.
That's what I keep thinking as you're talking.
Yeah, absolutely. This thing dwarfs all of our civilian problems. It's going to be just as costly or more costly to take care of than all the Superfund sites that we've accumulated over the same number of years or more, and all of the other kinds of contamination that we have to contend with. So it's right up there. It's a major problem. It's going to take 30 years or more to deal with. Just getting rid of the plutonium from the weapons themselves is going to be at least a 10 to 20 year job, even when we've made our decision as to what we do with it, because other people want to build new reactors to use it as a fuel or various other kinds of solutions for it, which are even more costly and risk the proliferation dangers. The world's not very stable right now, and there's no sign that it's going to be even more stable in the future, possibly far from it.
What does that mean to you relative to what you just said about the nuclear reactors and plutonium?
You mean the proliferation dangers?
Well, we began this hour talking about relatively less danger, so relatively more stability.
Ah, right, because we're not in a position to launch an all-out nuclear war at the moment.
Right.
Yeah. but small wars are not something to sneeze at. I mean, look at the damage that Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs did, and they're tiny compared to the ones that exist today. Those arsenals are still in existence, and most of the weapons are still intact. And some of the bigger ones are still in position and ready to launch and could be launched any time. We think it's very unlikely that the Russians are going to do that, and presumably we are not going to do it either. But as long as they exist, the potential for a war is still there. And it could be started by some power that has a few nuclear weapons and launches them and confuses people as to where they came from. Or small wars can turn into big wars, and there are all those possibilities.
That was always the fear in the 50s and the 60s that
a
mistake would happen.
Yeah.
The wrong button would be pushed.
It was a real mistake. The Cuban Missile Crisis really dramatized that.
Ann Ehrlich has been a member of and a consultant to a number of committees and commissions on this collection of topics. For example, she was a consultant to the Global 2000 report, a report produced in 1980 for the White House Council on Environmental Quality. She has served on the Commission for the Greater London Area War Risk Study from 1985 to 1986, and chaired the Military Impacts on the Environment Committee for the Sierra Club since 1985. In 1988, Ann Ehrlich was elected an honorary fellow in the California Academy of Sciences. The following year, she was selected for the United Nations Global 500 Roll of Honor for environmental achievement. And in 1990, Bethany College awarded her an honorary doctorate. Among other awards, she has been given the Humanist Distinguished Service Award, jointly with her husband, Paul Ehrlich, and the Raymond B. Bragg Award for Distinguished Service. Those both come from the American Humanist Association and came in 1985. She is now a life member of the American Humanist Association. Talking today about the environmental consequences of the arms race. Can you go back to the years when nuclear weapons were being tested, and give me a picture of what you think happens underground during an underground test? An above ground explosion, I can kind of wrap my consciousness around.
Yeah.
But underground, I'm not sure how it's set off or what happens. And do you think there's any environmental consequence to an underground explosion?
Oh, sure there is. Yeah. They set them off in vast man-made caverns, of course, and often what happens, I guess, is that the soil or the surrounding rock is essentially glassified, if you will. It's subjected to enormous pressure and heat and radioactivity.
So fused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Uh-huh. And sometimes they, what they call vent, that is, a little bit escapes to the atmosphere, that they aren't completely sealed off underground. I presume they are, well, obviously they're detonated remotely through a radio control or something.
Mm-hmm. And what vents is?
Oh, some of the explosive material just punches a hole in the surface and lets some radioactivity escape to the atmosphere. And this has happened in more than one test.
Is there any safe way to test a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, they can do it with computers. That's one reason for having a test ban. There's really no excuse for further testing. We know how those things work.
And with computers, and this is a modeling test.
Yeah, exactly.
I see.
So what they can do with the computers is work out, different configurations of the fissile materials and that kind of thing to see how they work and test the safety systems. They can test the safety systems without setting off a bomb, or they can use conventional explosives to do that too often. But when they say they have to have more tests, what you better believe is what they're trying to do is work on more sophisticated bomb designs. That's all.
Something else.
Yes, exactly.
This is another atomic bomb,
it's
hydrogen
just an
bomb
excuse.
Situation.
Oh, it's an excuse to keep the atomic engineers busy, the bomb designers. But they lobby very hard for their cause. The last American tests were only about 3 years ago, if that. And just since the first moratorium that George Bush announced and Clinton has continued, And the Russians have continued one at the same time. So,
do you see any lobbying to end the moratorium?
They stopped sooner than we did. See any lobbying to continue the moratorium?
End the moratorium? To begin testing again?
I wouldn't doubt it, but I haven't heard that there's been any this year. There certainly was for Clinton. There was a lot of pressure to get him to let it lapse. Mm-hmm. And he was very much on the fence about that and was finally persuaded. And again, it was Hazel O'Leary who pushed him over the edge and persuaded him that this was absolutely essential. You have to continue the moratorium. There's no excuse for setting off more tests. The British were very disappointed. They do their testing in our test site. If we have a moratorium, they can't do it either. But they've been even slower to recognize the end of the Cold War, I think, than we have. It's interesting.
What do you think the American people have to learn about this situation? What's the most important thing? You said you thought we were unaware, generally.
I think there are quite a few lessons to be learned here, but one is that government secrecy should always be looked at with something of a jaundiced eye and discouraged. And if you really want to have democracy, you have to have public oversight. There's just no way around it. That making weapons is not a risk-free business in itself at all, and that it's necessary to understand what's going on there. It's that things like Cold Wars should be avoided, that there have to be ways to, and I think in the modern world it's going to be very difficult for people to isolate themselves from each other in the way that they could in the 40s and 50s and 60s.
And they were isolated in two ways. This is a question.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that the Department of Energy said this is a national security issue, we'll regulate ourselves. And
yeah.
The second is that the defense industry itself did not come under any outside law or regulation.
Absolutely.
Are
they
the
do
two
now.
Major ones?
We passed a law. It went through in 1992. It was the last act that George Bush signed, I believe, was the Federal Facilities Compliance Act, which means that they must subject themselves to environmental regulation and worker safety oversight.
And safety and environmental regulation are the two most important issues.
Well, yes.
For this.
For independent agencies. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. what was missing here. But I wasn't thinking of that isolation. I was thinking of the isolation of the Americans from the Russians, from the Soviets, in understanding each other's societies. And we now know how much both sides were deluded about the other side, how much misinformation there was. And misunderstanding. And I think there are some real lessons for historians in there.
How do you think that isolation can be avoided, even as recently as the Persian Gulf War?
Well, I think CNN is doing it right now to a large extent. But it's that kind of general communication. I mean, it doesn't have to be government to government. People to people is just as important. Mm-hmm. And I think it also had a role in hastening the breakdown of the Soviet Union and in opening it up. I mean, there was a period, the Glasnost period, before the actual collapse of the regime. And I think that even before glasnost became a common word, at least on this side of the Iron Curtain, there was a lot of penetration. I know there was a lot of penetration by private people, and increasingly so throughout the 80s. It was a very interesting process. And I think it accomplished a lot in terms of making the Russians ready to say, we don't want a Cold War anymore, mm-hmm. and make it stick. But one also sees the same isolation with in the case of North Korea. And how we're going to break that one down, I don't know, because here's an old regime run by a guy in his 80s who's been there forever mm-hmm. and who has very carefully kept his public from knowing just what's going on in the world. I mean, it's a very censored society. And
where one can get in, it's journalism
yeah.
and private
Journalism
flow.
Is incredibly important, I think, private, people to people.
And where one can't get in, awareness is all, then, being very aware of what that other government is doing.
Yeah. There are, in fact, private citizens who have contacts in North Korea that have been involved in trying to sort things out in that way. In the same sort of way that scientists and others did with the Russians during the 80s. And nuclear winter played a big role in that, too, in that issue, in opening up contacts. It's very interesting. They opened up contacts with the scientists on the nuclear winter issue, which was very rapidly followed by the global warming issue. And many of the same people were involved in both of those issues, particularly the atmospheric scientists. And then it expanded into the biologists as well, because, of course, we had our role to play in dealing with nuclear winter. And we also have a role to play in global warming. So the scientific community has been very active in all of these things and building on itself, developing networks, if you like.
Bridges.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So,
and I see this process operating all over the world. It's also expanding into the third world to some extent.
Which is very good news.
Yeah, and of course we've had UN conferences to facilitate that, and which they have. This is a piece of those conferences that people don't know about, and they think they failed when they didn't sign a convention, but no.
They're more interactive than that.
The much more interesting part of what they do and the more important part of what they do is the bridge building.
Okay, so this is quite a list already. There's oversight, breaking down isolation, journalistically, privately, and
people feedback
in science. Mm-hmm. What else? I'm thinking of that initial question: is what do Americans have to know about the arms race? Whether it's
that it's going to cost them an arm and a leg in the future, even though it's all over. And that they're going to have to deal with it, some very real issues, and that there are still some very real dangers in terms of the world community and how nations interact. I mean, the danger of war is still there, not in the same way, not in the same hair trigger way, but the materials still exist and they have to be dealt with. We can't just ignore it and shove it under a rug somewhere. And at the same time, we also have to deal with the fact that people don't want them in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have to come to grips with it as a society. It's a big, big issue to deal with. The solutions won't be easy.
I'm not quite sure how to get to this next question. In the years that you have been researching this collection of issues, you have to have thought a good deal about how nations and individuals can find alternatives to Cold War attitudes, alternatives to freezing each other out. You sat on a commission, perhaps, something called the Center for Innovative
Diplomacy. Yes.
Does that have any answers to my question? Because that's what I was wondering about.
Well, I'll tell you. That's one of the cases of people to people. The young man who founded that has a degree in international law, and he was very interested in both the environment and in Cold War issues. And he was traveling to Russia and meeting people, and he was involved with others who were, and he and a young woman who I knew as a student co-authored a book called The New Diplomats, where they documented various individuals from Norman Cousins on down to the Iowa farmer who went over as early as the 1950s, people who had contacts in Russia of one kind or another, all sorts of different kinds. I mean, the farmer, Norman Cousins, who talked to Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis, to people who just wanted to do sports with their Russian counterparts or climb mountains or whatever. And just very nice stories. There was a teacher who went over and did some teaching and learned how they do it in Russian schools. That was very interesting, by the way. And it was quite a lovely book, and it came out around 1985, I would guess, or 86. And then he founded the Center for Innovative Diplomacy, and one of the things that they did was sister cities. mostly with Russians, and set up sister cities, and they also encouraged city governments to have their own foreign policies. And people were doing it anyway. I mean, a lot of chambers of commerce in cities were encouraging trade relations with foreign countries and not bothering with Washington, thank you very much. This was already happening, but all they did was, you know, sort of encourage it and develop a communication among cities in America who were doing these kinds of things so they could trade ideas and maybe cooperate in some of their ventures. So that was an interesting thing, and I think this is another sort of thing that's happening around the world that people aren't really noticing. But there's an awful lot of commercial contact all around the world that's going on. The world's being knit closer together, sort of under our feet without our noticing.
Is this
in all sorts of ways?
Is this one of the more optimistic signs, if mm-hmm. we look ahead at a future without war?
Yes,
it
absolutely.
Happens this way?
Mm-hmm. Of course, the more you have contact with other people, the less likely you are to go to war with them, and especially if you have commercial investments with them, trade agreements. You know, you're trading something to them and they're trading something to you, and you're more or less dependent on that. Unless something goes wrong with that, very wrong, you're not likely to go to war.
How did you get involved in this?
Well, in the nuclear war issue?
Yeah.
Well, it started for me principally with the nuclear winter business. But, you know, I'd always had an interest in the arms race and the war issue, but more, not actively.
And was it that image was so compelling as a possible future that you felt you had to be involved?
Oh, well, I was very interested in trying to help visualize and then to explain to the public what the results for human populations and for biota, you know, after all the biological systems we depend upon, in the event of a nuclear war and a nuclear winter, the nuclear winter effects, what would that do to crops, for example? What would that do to food supplies and wildlife and livestock and the whole picture? And to try to help work that out. And then the Glauwers thing. The Glauwers Commission produced a report on what would happen to the Greater London area. This was commissioned by the City of London. In the event of a nuclear war. And we did several scenarios, one that barely touched London and one that was really serious, and tried to put everything together, the medical results, the physical results in terms of destruction of buildings and so forth, and how many houses would be left for how many people who survived, and then we added on a nuclear winter component, which had never been done before, and I think that study still stands as the most complete one of its type for showing exactly what would happen to a given region in the event of a particular kind of nuclear exchange. And that was a very interesting exercise. Put together people from all sorts of disciplines, from economics and sociology to the physical scientists who worked out the exchanges and the detonation effects and the whole works.
Is this kind of specificity what is needed to understand exactly how much we don't want to face
yeah.
that reality?
Yeah, I think, well, that was the purpose of it. Mm-hmm. That and that the British Home Office apparently had some rather delirious ideas of what the public would do if something happened and really of what the results would be. I mean, they were living in something of a dream world in terms of their own guidelines of what they thought people would do or should do. And to a degree, this was done in response to that, to show both the public and the government of Britain that things were much worse than they thought they would be, that they shouldn't be complacent about the possibility of a nuclear war.
Is that the other worst thing that can happen, is that we could become complacent again about the possibility?
I think it's entirely possible we could become complacent about having the materials around and the possibility of somebody, you know, putting together another arsenal. It is possible, and I think at the moment people are working toward getting a really good global fix on dealing with it, but we've got a long way to go. The United States has to be willing to subject itself to international controls. That's only fair. And they aren't going to get cooperation from other countries unless they do. And the same goes for Russia.
Who's spearheading this? Is this United Nations?
The United Nations is very active in it. There are quite a few NGOs that are active on it. There are people in the present administration that are very concerned about it. The scientific community is very interested, those who've traditionally been interested in the nuclear issues.
Ann Ehrlich, thank you very much for
thank
a very interesting hour. This has been Ann Ehrlich with us on Conversations. Our subject today, the environmental effects of the arms race and related topics. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you join me again next week. Thanks again.